Hi, I'm Todd Jackson. I'm an alcoholic.
Todd!
Because of God's grace, AA, and sponsorship, I have been sober since May 25th of 1989, and I'm grateful. You could really do some funny stuff with what's been going on here, but I won't. I will use some self-control. I first would like to thank the committee for their hospitality and being invited anywhere and being asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. For me, is an extreme privilege. I am not the kind of person that ought to get to do it, to be honest with you. And I know my wife's not. You heard this delicate flower story last night. I'd like to thank her for her talk, fantastic talk last night. She just keeps getting better. She and I have been through so much, and she's a fine lady in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I respect her. I'd like to thank our hosts, Ron and Carol. And Ron, if you read your program, Carol has undergone some surgery. Now, they've been very, very helpful and very thoughtful and have taken care of us. And if we have to eat any more this weekend, I'm going to die. I've gained about 7 pounds since I got off the plane. You all have just been fantastic. Just as it is, any time that we go anywhere and do anything in AA, it's always good. It's always been nice, and you certainly extended that hand to us, and we appreciate that. I know I do. I'd also like to thank my sponsor for being here. I know he came down just to hear me. That was the fantasy I had until I read his name on the back of the flyer. Thanks. My good friend Gary Peek is here, and you know what I was thinking about? I got this little deal here, this little mic on, and I thought, I shouldn't turn it on too early because you might pick up what I'm thinking. And what I was thinking is, give me my pen and let me get out of here. That's what I was thinking. Let's go to the dance. You know, you squeeze me in between the countdown and the dance, and I just want the pen so we can go dance. I don't know. That's just how I think. I have strange mental blank spots. It's good to see my friend Margaret. I love Margaret. I met last year, and she is a sweetheart. She seems to be stalking me. I think we need to security. She's everywhere I am. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all I know. I have never been anywhere else that I have. That I've been able to stay and be comfortable. And for a person like me to be comfortable not drinking is somewhat of a miracle, honestly. I don't mean to get all foo-foo and soft on you, but I'm going to tell you right now, for me to be comfortable without drinking alcohol or any dope is a miracle. That's just because I'm the kind of person who, if I don't have Alcoholics Anonymous or a drink, then I'm a nut. I'm irritable, I'm restless, and I'm discontent. And I am not fun to be around. I'm not a joyful person. I'm not happy. And so I need this program very much. And more than needing it, I love it. I want to be here. I enjoy being with you. You've become... You okay? All right. Scare me. I'm a little paranoid still, Ron. Yeah, I've only been here 10 years. It takes a little while for that stuff to wear off. In addition to needing to be here, I love to be here. This is my place, and you're my people, and so I'm grateful to have the opportunity to be here tonight. I was born and raised in a town called Shawnee, Oklahoma, and for most people that live there, that's enough reason to drink right there. And it's like 30,000 people, and I think we've got 7 AA groups. Now, if you do the math on that, there's like 1 AA group for every 4,000 people. I mean, that's amazing, right? I don't know what the deal is. It's in the water or something, but I didn't, you know, I wasn't born, I don't know that I was born alcoholic. I know that I was born feeling a little different. And you hear that a lot of times from the podium, and it sort of becomes cliche when you hear that about people feeling different. But I want you to know that I felt different. I don't know how you felt, but I felt different. I felt weird. And that didn't start until I was about 6 months old, from as far as back I can remember. I came into this world to a couple of folks that were not ready to have a child. They were young. They were young people. My mom, I think, was 15, and my dad was 16, you know, that's just the way it was, and they got divorced, and I was about 6 months old, and for a long time I thought that was the reason that I was the way that I was. And that's pretty popular in a lot of places. But for that to be the reason. Unfortunately, that doesn't work for me. It has no solution, absolutely none, and I just keep getting sicker while I think it's someone else's fault. So it's not a good thing. And so, but I thought that for a long time, and I would. They got divorced, and my mom married a couple of other guys. Well, one other guy, I don't remember. This one, I don't know. The one guy that I remember the most was a fellow. I always hate this part because there's always somebody in the crowd. He was a big, mean truck driver. And sorry, Charlie, back there. Not all truck drivers are mean, I'm sure. This guy was a big, mean, belt-whipping, beer-drinking jerk. I mean, he exuded meanness. I mean, he'd walk into a room and the room would get darker. I mean, that's how I perceived it whenever I was a kid. And he drank Stag beer. And for God's sakes, if you drink, I mean, think about Stag beer for a minute. Stag. Just think about the word stag. That's not even a good sounding word. Why would you drink that? And in fact, they stopped making it. Killed 3 people in Arkansas, and they stopped making it. They just, no more. And so this guy drank this Stag beer, and he brought with him this tribe of kids. And he was part Indian, and they were full-blood Cherokee or Savage or something. I don't know. I had been out in the country. I lived out in the country, and I had a dog named Pepper, and I had a BB gun, and that was all I needed, you know. I mean, that's all I want. And then here come these folks, you know, and they move in, and they're like dark complected, and they have pretty skin, and they're brown, and they have pretty eyes, and I got freckles like this big all over. I mean, it's hideous. And I've got ears big, and I was born weighing about 40 pounds, and I didn't change that until about 5 years ago when I gained 200 pounds. But it was just ridiculous. I felt awful. And I, you know, one time a guy told me, he said, you're about 100 pounds and about 60 of it's mouth, isn't it? And I, no, you know, I don't know, maybe. But I just remember feeling awful. I remember they came and they wanted to mess with all my stuff. They wanted to play with my toys. And I'm selfish and self-centered, and I don't like people messing with my stuff. And that hasn't stopped, really. It's gotten a little better, but, you know, I have certain things that are mine and don't mess with them. And that doesn't work very well when you have a couple of kids. But I just didn't like it. I wanted what was mine. I wanted what was yours, and I didn't want you around to mess with me. And it didn't work out very well. And my mother and this gentleman divorced, which I was grateful for. I drank some of his Stag beer. I drank, and it was terrible. It tasted like it sounded. I mean, it was awful to me. And I had an idea of what a person was like that drank beer. Now, I was not raised overly religious family. I understood what who God was, and I understood that you should be nice, and all those sort of core principles. I had those things. My grandparents really helped with that. They were salt of the earth people. They would give you anything you needed. My grandmother was one of those people that if she saw you in need, she fulfilled that need. Pretty much. I mean, she was just that kind of person. And my grandfather was my hero. He rode in the rodeo, and he was in the war, and he was a postman, and he's my hero. And he still is today. So I was given some good things. I was given some things. If you're baking a cake, and you said, here's all the ingredients that you need to have a good cake, I got them all. I got all the good stuff. I gave everything that you could have needed or wanted, I had. We didn't have any money. We're not rich by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, we were poor. We were poor. The school bought my shoes. I mean, sounds kind of cliche. We didn't walk uphill both ways to school or anything like that. I mean, it was just, we were just poor, you know, and I remember how that felt. It felt bad, you know, and when my mom divorced this guy, I felt better because I thought that he was probably the problem. I drank some of that beer, didn't have any effect on me, and I had an idea of what a person was like that drank. And they were mean, and they were, you know, they were just nasty folks. And that was my idea of that. And so my mother went along and she met another guy And this gentleman was, he was to become, or he would do for me at that time what alcohol would do for me later. It just sort of sealed in all the gaps, you know, sort of filled up the holes and made me whole, made me feel like I had some unity. And I couldn't have put words to that at that time, but that's indeed what it felt like to me, was that I was just, it cinched it up for me. I felt better. And unfortunately for a person like me, people don't have enough power to make me feel good. They just, it doesn't last. It's there for a moment and then it's gone. And that's how it felt, and that's how it was. And we moved to California, and my understanding was if you're broke in Oklahoma, you move to California, because that's what we did. And we moved out there, and I became involved in sports and all the sort of things that you would think that a young person would do, and I did those things, and I was a pretty good little baseball player, and I just had friends, and it was like I fit in. It was really like I fit in. I felt good. And ironically, that is the place that I had my first experience with alcohol of any consequence. That is where I experienced the effect that's produced by alcohol in my body, which I have come to know is different than it is for normal folks. We went to a party at a place called Arnes Lake. And Arnes Lake was a lake in the mountains. We lived in Tehachapi, California. And it's a beautiful little town, and there's mountains all around it, and the snow's up there, and it's just beautiful. And that's where we were at that night. And I tell this story because it illustrates for me exactly what it is that alcohol does for me, and exactly why I drank it. And what happened was, you have to remember that I was a little guy, a little short kid with big ears and red hair and freckles, and didn't feel very good about myself. And I began to drink this alcohol, some beer, it was just beer, and I started to feel better. And I don't know, if you know how that is, you know how that is. You can't explain that to a non-alcoholic. It's impossible. But I want you to know that something happened to me that night that made me feel warm. It made me feel big. It made me feel, it just made me feel like I could take a big, deep breath for the first time. I mean, it seemed as if before this time that I could only get a breath about right here. And that night when I drank that beer, I was able to take a big, deep breath. And that was, and I don't know that I would have known that I wasn't breathing like that before had I not taken that drink. But I know when I drank that, a sense of peace and relief came upon me, and I felt better, and I felt like I could do anything that I wanted. And this was only after a few beers. And there was a gal there, and I'm going to set the scene for you so you need to really visualize this so you get the full effect. We're standing out there in the lake in the mountains, and there's this little hill, and all of a sudden the sun's going down, and there's a gal riding a white stallion. She's riding a white stallion, and she's coming over the hill, and her hair's blowing in the wind, and she's got blonde hair, of course, and the sun is just sort of glittering through her hair. And I mean I was in love with her. I get chills now thinking, God, it was like, and I'd seen her all night, and it was like, where did she come from, you know? And it wasn't the horse, I tell you. I mean, oh my God. And I just was in love with Stephanie, and I thought, I should go talk to Stephanie. I went over there, and I laid some, I'm sure it was fantastic line. I mean, you know, I'm 12 years old, what do you, past the Crayolas, I don't know what it was, but I laid something on her, you know, and I got her out on the boat, which was the deal, you know. And the problem, there's always a problem in my life. There's always the story. Here, let me tell you real quick, you will understand my life if you watch the Buffalo Bills game today. That is my life, right there. Isn't that an awesome, you have an awesome feeling, and then you get screwed. Every time, that's the deal for me. So I got this awesome feeling, I'm feeling great, I'm out on the boat, and this guy, Troy, is there. And it's like, I didn't see Troy the whole time, and then all of a sudden I see Troy. And I'm thinking, why is he here? What's he going to do? You know, and I'm not perverted enough yet to be weird. You know, I'm just a kid, and I'm going, somehow he's got to get off this boat. You know, this is not a big enough boat for all three of us, and so I don't know. We got in a little scrap or something. I think I took him. I'm I'm quite sure I did. But what happened was, and there's really no easy way to say it. I mean, I peed in a Dorito bag and threw up. That's sort of that play at the end of the game, you know, the Bills game. Oh, you just go, my gosh, how does that happen? It's like you're outside of yourself going, this can't be happening. This can't be happening. This is happening. Oh my God, this is happening. I lived my life that way. It was as if all the time there was a weight just pressing me down. And there was nothing solid under my feet, and I was just sinking all the time, and there was some sort of a cloud around me that I couldn't see through, and there was always a mystery. There was always something outside of myself that if I could put a finger on it, I would be able to say, that's the problem. That's what's wrong with me. That's why I feel this way. These are the things that would make me better. Here, fix me. But I could never put a finger on it. Ever. But there was always something wrong. The feeling of impending doom. Always. Always. And that night was no exception. But that was the first night that I experienced the effect that is produced by alcohol. Now, besides that peeing in a Dorito bag and throwing up part, the rest of it was pretty good. You know, if alcohol affects you the way that it affects me, why wouldn't you drink it? You know, there's really nothing logical, illogical about me drinking alcohol. It makes me feel good. Yeah, there are some side effects, like the peeing in the Dorito bag and the throwing up part, but do you not understand how good it makes me feel? Now, you try to explain that to somebody who's not alcoholic, and they will put you in a nut house. I promise. And so that sort of set me on a journey of having to have that feeling and having those sort of things happen in my life and trying to explain them to people who had no idea what I was talking about. It's very frustrating. And we ended up moving back to Oklahoma, because if you go broke in California, you move back to Oklahoma. It's grapes of wrath in reverse. We just shot back to Oklahoma, and I hated it. There were some cultural differences in California. Oklahoma's really not on the cutting edge of anything. And there were some differences in the way that we dressed. I won't even go into it. It was embarrassing. It had to do with underwear. And I wore a different kind of underwear, and it was really, it shouldn't have been a big deal, but if it's about me, it's a big deal, you know. And I was crazy, and I hated it here in Oklahoma, and I didn't want to be there, and I didn't like most of the people there, and what I did was I found some people that I guess felt like I did, or we identified with somehow with each other, and we started to drink on weekends, very innocently, just, you know, we were 13, 14 years old, whatever it was, and we began to drink on weekends, and for some reason, the effect that was produced in me seemed to be a little different than it was produced in them a lot of times. I didn't have the ability to stop drinking. I didn't have the ability to know when to say when, you know. My folks have been preaching moderation to me since I can remember. If you're going to drink, don't drink so much. They had no idea what it is to be an alcoholic. Because when I introduce any alcohol into my system, I don't have the ability, I don't have the power to say how much I'm going to take or when I'm going to stop or what's going to happen. And I started to experience that frequently. And I blacked out and I got in trouble and all the sort of things that happens to you whenever you drink and you're a young person. I did drugs and it got to be where the people around me wouldn't, you know, and I was hanging out with people that robbed and stuff like that, and they would not let me go. I mean, we were going to go steal a truck one night, and they said, and it's not like you're going, it's not a bank robbery. I mean, you're not going, you know, it's not like you're going to CIA secret, we're going to rip off an old farm truck. And they said, no, you can't go, you'll get us in trouble. And I thought, what a bunch of crap. I mean, you could think you're a 007 or something. I mean, we're going out to a farm to steal a truck, and I couldn't go. But it was always like that in my life because I don't know what it was. I have no idea. I know the way that I felt. And I felt like that I was smarter than most people. In fact, if I had a few minutes in my own head standing here, I would figure out that I was a lot smarter than you. That's just the way I am. And I'm a lot more complex, and I feel things at a deeper level, and I'm a lot more sensitive than most of you. And that's very difficult to explain to people. I mean, they don't get it. And so you stop trying. I mean, how do you explain to somebody that you really feel like you're more complex than they are? What you think is, they won't understand anyway, because I'm smarter than they are, and I'm more complex, and it's way over their head. And so you just go, forget it. And so at this time in my life, things are not going very well. They're not terribly bad, but they're not going well. And my real dad came back into my life about that time, and we sort of became friends, and he liked to drink, and I liked to drink, and he liked to do dope, and I liked to do dope, and it was not a healthy relationship by any means, but we had a relationship. We were friends or whatever, and I moved out, lived with him. When I say I lived with him, we lived in a house. We had a mattress, we had some forks, and we had a killer stereo. He was not on the way up at that time in his life, and neither was I. And we used to lay back there on this old mattress, and we'd drink wine. And it was a period of our lives where we both liked to drink wine. And so we were drinking wine, and I would talk about this gal in my life that had really screwed me over. And he'd talk about my mom. And I would go, I don't want to hear this. Oh, what the hell, you know, and I'd pass in the jug over there, and he'd talk. And I just, but that's just the way it was, you know, and I had fallen in love with this little gal, and I hate this part. You heard it, haven't you? I used to not tell her because I was afraid, but she happened to be gay. And it's sort of that Buffalo Bill deal. I mean, but you know what I'm saying? It's the, oh my God, look at her. She's gorgeous. All right. Oh my God, she's gay. And I'm thinking, well, can there be any more? Is there any more punishment that you can bestow on me, God? I mean, I was just obsessed. I was a stalker when I was 15. I mean, I was just lurching around in the dark, waiting for her to come out of her house, and her dad's running me off with a shotgun, chasing me out of their house, and I just obsessed, crazy. And I, being the sensitive and intelligent and complex human being that I am, I decided that I could deal with it. That I would change her. A couple of suicide attempts later, I decided I better move on because she was not going to change. In fact, she's married in Texas somewhere now to a lady. But, you know, at that time in my life, that was not good for me. That was not good for my psyche. It'll make you question your manhood a little bit. And I was having boyhood anyway, so I wasn't doing very well. I was not, wasn't good. Anyway, and so it was just, there's a theme that sort of developed in my life, and it was that it'll be good for a little bit, and then you're going to get screwed. And I don't know how that is. I sort of brought that into my own life somehow, but anyway, I ended up going to treatment. My real dad got divorced, and myself and his wife, ex-wife, were going to go take his furniture or take his clothes or something to him in Lawton, Oklahoma. And we got on the road about 7:30 in the morning. We started drinking Michelob, and we started smoking them funny left-handed cigarettes. And by about 9, I was in a blackout. And somewhere in there, she had asked me if I wanted to drive. What do you think? Yeah, I don't want to drive right now. And I came to, and we were hitting a bridge, doing about 70 miles an hour, and it was an awful thing. It was a terrible, terrible time. And my stepmother was in the front, and of course we didn't wear seat belts. And I had my little sister was in the back, who at the time was 3 years old, my half sister, and we hit this bridge, and it was an awful thing. And I remember sort of coming to, and if you've ever been involved in an accident like that, it sort of happens in slow motion. I mean, I saw everything going on. I saw her hit and me hit and everything happening. And then we got out of there. So we got out and we were in the ambulance, and the highway patrolman is talking to me, and I was obviously drunk. And I was obviously in trouble. And he said something. He said, it's a good thing that you didn't hit those brakes, because you would have, I guess they were looking for brake marks. And he says, it's a good thing you didn't hit those brakes, because you'd have flipped the car if you'd hit the brakes and killed everyone in the car. And I was thinking to myself, I don't even know we have brakes. I mean, I was completely in a black. I mean, I had no idea. There were no taillights behind me. I mean, if you're looking at me and you're behind me, there's no sign. You're thinking, that boy is going to hit that bridge. And that's what happened, in fact. And it destroyed my stepmom's face. It just shattered it into pieces, and it broke my collarbone, and ripped the lining away from my stomach, and my ribs were broken, and collarbone sticking out of my stepsisters or half sisters, and everybody's beat up, and they take me to the hospital, and my folks came to see me. My stepdad, who came into my life and just sort of sealed everything up, he and my mother, and they got my sisters, and you've heard of guilt trips. My folks take them. When I get in trouble or I'm in the hospital, they load up every relative they can find and come and see me in the hospital. And so I was in the emergency room a lot in the hospital, and they came in, and I was not doing well. I mean, I was not in good shape. And my mom asked me a series of questions, which I'll never forget, because it was so painful. And I had, at this time, things had progressed to a state that it was not good. I mean, I was fighting with my stepdad, and I mean, physically we were fighting. If you've never seen him, but he's about 6'3", about 250 pounds. It's not a fight that I'm ever going to win. And just it was a bad thing. And they came, and my mom is, I'm my mother's firstborn son. I'm her only son, and I'm her firstborn. And I know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that my mother would literally give up breath so that I could live. And if you're a mother or if you're a father, you probably understand that. And I know that. And I remember her coming into that emergency room, and I remember her looking at me, as she had begun to do recently at that time. And she looked at me with all the disgust and the irritation and the aggravation and the pain and the love and the understanding and the misunderstanding. Her eyes just seemed to burn into me, and I laid there, and she asked me these questions like, why do you do this? And I just got tears streaming down my cheeks, and I'm thinking, I don't know. I don't have any idea. And she says, the final question that she asked me was, have you had enough? And I thought, you don't understand. I had enough. I mean, this is what I thought, and I didn't think all of it through until later in sobriety, but what I thought, I remember thinking, you don't understand. It's crazy. I can't explain it to you. And it wasn't real detailed. I mean, but there was always that madness, and there was always that cloud and the mystery and not knowing, and knowing there was a problem somewhere and not being able to put my finger on it, and the feeling as if I was sinking. And there seemed to be always layers over my eyes where I couldn't see things very clearly, and it was almost as if it was a blur, and I couldn't get a deep breath anymore. But how do you explain that? And I couldn't explain that to her, and I just shrugged. I mean, I had one good shoulder, and I just kind of shrugged it, and I just lay there. And I don't know what happened. They went away, or they did something. And I ended up in a treatment center there in Salina, Kansas, as a matter of fact. St. Warts or something, St. John's, bring it on. And I went to St. John's, and I was a stellar patient. I left briefly for an evening. I smoked Carmex, which is hideous. It's headache in a jar, if you ever want to know. If you ever locked up anywhere and you want to, don't smoke Carmex. I pulled it together there for a little while, and they made me the guy who walks around giving out chores, whatever that guy is. the guy everybody else hates in treatment. You know, that's the guy I was. And so, but they caught me kissing this little gal behind the stairs there, and they busted me down to private or wow, whatever it was. And I took my notebook away, is what they did, and I was just one of the guys. And I got hurt playing football in there, busted my knee up really, really good, and they sent me home. And I didn't make any breakthroughs in that place. I didn't make any. I lied, and I didn't tell them the truth, and I didn't want to be there, and I didn't want any help. And I remember they would take me to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would think, oh my God, look at these old people. Jesus. And I would think, what a bunch of idiots. And I mean, I really thought that. I really thought, are you weak? I mean, why are you here? I understood. I've been in treatment. I saw the film. I know about it. I mean, are you weak? I mean, suck it up, please. And so I got out and I went home and a couple, I don't know, a few hours after I was out, I went to a party and I remember sitting at this party and I was sitting there. I was completely sober, and I was sitting up. My leg was in this cast and wrapped up, and I was sitting on the edge of the cabinet in the kitchen, and all my friends were saying, "Man, we're glad you're back, and we know you're not drinking anymore, so don't mind us," you know. And they're all drunk and stoned, and I was thinking, I am all alone, and I've talked to literally dozens of alcoholics who have felt completely and totally alone in a crowd of people. And I remember specifically that night feeling completely and totally alone in that crowd. And what happened was, within 30 minutes or so, I was back to doing what I know how to do best that makes me fit in, which is to drink and to do dope. And it continued to get worse. I ended up having to go to another treatment center because of some unfortunate circumstances one summer. And I met my lovely wife at Greenleaf in Shawnee, where it's a new beginning. And that's what we had, was a new beginning. We got the little green pen, and we graduated. I don't know what we graduated. We went to the deal, and we went to aftercare, and we'd go to aftercare, and aftercare, we would go get drunk. That's how we did aftercare. All of us in the whole group would get in the car, and we'd go right around and drink and smoke weed. And our parents would be at coffee, and that's how we did aftercare. And it worked out that way. I remember for a little while, the way that I got into that place was that I was drunk, and I had taken some pills, and I overdosed. I was bad to overdose. I was not good at measuring, not a good measurer. And so I would always do more or take more than I should. And that particular time, I'd overdosed on some Halidol, which is not good. And they gave it to me later to even me out, you know. And anyway, so I had this trouble, and I got into this treatment center, and I was not doing, you know, well. I had this side effect, was that my head would, I mean, I was just going to seizures, and which is attractive. You know, I like to call it suave. I'm just not well. That's desperation. I was not doing well. I mean, I literally had been in convulsions for about 13 hours before I came into that treatment center. If you've ever been in the convulsions, they're tiring. You are working if you're in convulsions, buddy. I mean, you are, every muscle group is getting a workout, and I am just sane. I called everybody I knew, told them I was going to die. I said, I'm going to go to this treatment center because if I don't die, I've got to get better. And so I went to this place, and I really wanted to be sober for a little bit. Anyway, we got out, and Satchi described last night exactly what happened, and that's the way it happened. I said, "Do you ever think about it?" She said, "Yeah, I do." And I said, "You want it?" And we were gone. And that's just the way it was. I had no mental defense against the first drink. Absolutely none. Didn't know that that was a problem. Had no idea that I suffered from an illness. that I had no power over, had no idea of that. And her and I, as she said again, we got pregnant and the baby didn't make it, and of course I felt awful. As usual, I felt like that was about me and that I was being punished and that it was my fault, which it may have been, I don't know. I choose to believe today that God takes care of that kind of stuff. And I believe that He's taking care of it. So we ended up getting married anyway. I remember we got home, as she said, we passed out in full clothes, night of our honeymoon. We did very romantic. And I remember we pulled up to our little apartment, and there was two guys standing on our porch, and they both had four cases of beer. Like one here, one here, one here, and one here, both of them. And they're just standing there, and I guess they were just waiting on us. I guess if we hadn't come home, they'd still be there now. I don't know. They were just waiting on us to get home. We pulled in, and the party started, and it was a sick home from day one. Sassy held back a little information on me from the start. You know, she didn't tell me that she was a complete psychopath. When we started the date, she held that back because she needed it later, I guess. Complete, crazy, psychopathic, violent, alcoholic woman. And that's my wife. But that, again, is just like that Buffalo Bills game. I mean, isn't it? You know, I'm in love, and she's gorgeous, and I'm a fruit. I mean, I'm just a goofball. I look like a freak. I got long hair, earrings just hanging out of my ears, literally hanging out of my ears. I'm a freak, and I've landed a good one. You know, I'm like the envy of Shawnee. You know, I got the one, you know. And she's wearing leather boots up there, you know what. I mean, I'm just going, woohoo! And then she's a psycho. I mean, she broke my nose with a belt buckle one night. That's funny, isn't it? Tell you what, it wasn't very damn funny that night. Because I had to figure out how I was going to tell Stan, my partner on the coke route, that my wife broke my nose. So I made up an elaborate story that a box fell out of the top of the closet and clobbered me. That's the way it was. And I am just sick, just very sick. And you know, I didn't know what to do about that. She would enter meeting or something stupid like that. I went to meetings sometimes drunk. Stone, didn't want your solution, wanted to not hurt, wanted to not be in trouble. Excuse me. But there came a time in the middle of May when I was out of options. Sassy had gotten sober in March, and We had a relationship was such that it was like we hated each other and we loved each other, and we hated each other and we loved each other, and talked to a lot of people, and that's sort of how every alcoholic relationship is, you know. And we had a saying about our relationship, and I'll tell you about it after the meeting. It's not appropriate from the podium. Very physical. And she got sober, and it was as if my drinking friend had gone away, my drinking partner had gone away, because we got along pretty good when we were sober. I mean, when we were drinking, it was when we were sober, we didn't get along very well. And I decided that I was going to go to Texas because I didn't want any part of this. And at that time, I was down to about 113 pounds. And I was literally half the man that I am today. Literally. Anyway, I was not well. I had had double hernia surgery. They had put me on Dilata. Bad choice. Tell you right now, it was a bad choice. They did, in fact, come and take it from me. I got out of the hospital and I was gone for about a day. I just couldn't take it. I had to go. You know, I just had to. She sent the police looking for me, and I'm hunched over. I walk like, you know, I got 16 staples in my gut, and I'm not doing it. I don't have the power not to. I don't have the power to say, you know what? I'll do that this weekend. I'm going to go home and heal. I just don't have any power, so I've got to go do whatever it is that I have to do. And I did that. And she had gotten sober, and it was just not well around the house, and I decided that I was going to go to Texas, and my real dad lived there, and I went there, and I was completely and totally in madness. I could not stop the things that go on in my head. I could not stop the racing. I could not stop the thoughts of the people that I'd hurt and the things that I had done and the problems that I had caused. My mother had waited and found me coming in and had stopped me in the driveway and said, "Do not come to our home anymore. Your sisters cannot see you this way. We don't want to see you this way. We're just waiting for the call. You know, we're waiting for the call because we know you're going to die." And I had had some brushes, you know, with some things, and I didn't think that I was going to make it either. I really had no idea that I would live as long as I have, or I'd take a lot better care of myself, to tell you. But I just didn't care, and that's sort of the consequences. That's just sort of the price that you pay. And her mother had done pretty much the same, and I just didn't have anybody left or anything left, and I went to Texas, and that's when it was over for me. I surrendered at a level that I have, well, it's not been necessary for me to have to take a drink to this day because of that surrender. And partially because of that surrender. I was done. I work with a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous today, and I hear them say about their family, or about their job, or about this, or about that. And when I was done, I was just done. It didn't matter. I didn't know. I wasn't sure what was going to happen, you know. And that's how I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I came back to Oklahoma. I went back to Oklahoma, and I found a guy. I went to a treatment center because I could no longer not drink. I mean, I had to have some sort of physical detachment from alcohol. It was necessary for me to drink in the morning. It was necessary for me to drink a lot and to do a lot of drugs. And I began to shake, and I began to sweat, and I'd had these visions. I like to think that they were visions of little people out in my front yard walking around waiting for me to come outside. We call them yard narcs in Oklahoma. I don't know what y'all call them. They are out there. And I was scared. I didn't like it. And that's how I came to you. I went to this detox center, and I stayed there, and they gave me apple juice and Jumpin' Jacks, and I was just like a bowl of jelly. I was dead. And they'd say, there was a guy there that was sort of like Sergeant, what's his name, on Gomer Pyle. He had just a little fart. I mean, I just want to kill him. He just always up in your face, you know, confronting me. Look, I didn't need to be confronted. You know, I was done. I didn't need to be confronted. He was telling me I need to get tough, and I just, I'm looking at him going, man, you don't get it. You know, I am done. There ain't any more getting tough. I am just done. And I had previous to getting there, I'd sat on the corner of my bed with a shotgun, and I was just trying to figure out how to do it. And I'd done that many times. And I don't know anything worse for a person like me to be crazy enough to want to die. I mean, with everything, to want to die, but to not be crazy enough to go ahead and do it. And that's a very lonely, lonely place and a very painful place to be. And that's where I was at. And so I was surrendered, and I decided that I would try Alcoholics Anonymous. So I left that place against their advice, and I'd been to treatment before, and I'd said, you know, a couple times, and I said, I'm going to go to AA. And they said, you'll never make it, and I probably shouldn't have. They said that you need to stay here for 30 more days, and I'm not knocking that deal. I know they were doing what they thought was best. But for me, recovery is not treatment. You know, treatment is a place to go and, you know, get yourself feeling a little bit better, I guess. I don't know. But it, for me, my recovery began one night. The night that I got out, I went to Shawnee, and I looked a guy up named Steve. And Steve had been my sponsor one time at a treatment center. Now, he never knew he was my sponsor because that's how I operated. But in order to get out of the treatment center, you had to have a sponsor. So he left his name at one of the Bridge of the Gap deals, and I showed him the card and said, this is my sponsor. And so I went to this place and I looked up Steve. And there's a few things I want to touch on, and one of them is the importance of having a home group. Steve had a home group. And this counselor lady, who I appreciate so very much, said, "Here's where he'll be. He'll be at the Big Book Group at East Highland or West Highland Street." And so I went down there, and that was not Steve's committed meeting. Steve had just gone by there because he was involved in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's what we are, is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope. And that night was not a committed meeting for him. He had just gone by because it was such a part of the way that he lived that he just went by to see the people who were in his life, to hang out and drink coffee with the guys after the meeting. And I went in there, and I looked him up, and I was blubbering, and I was dying, and he did for me the greatest thing that's ever been done for a person like me. He took me in his car, and he told me his story. The book Alcoholics Anonymous has a chapter called Working with Others. And I suppose he'd read it, because he did exactly what it said. He told me about his life. He told me funny stories. And I told him some of mine. And whenever the mood was heavy, he bore down the seriousness of this malady, of how I was not going to be able to make it. And for some reason, when he told me that, I believed him. I've been to a psychiatrist, I've been to a faith healer, which is a whole other story. I've been to a lot of places where people didn't understand, where I knew, I looked right through them, and I knew they didn't understand. But for some reason, whenever another alcoholic sat down with me and shared their experience, strength, and hope, for the first time in my life, I felt like I understood and I was being understood. And it was almost as if I'd come home, like this is what I've been missing. And I don't ever want to forget that, and I don't ever want to not do that for someone else. Because I tell you, that's why I'm here tonight. He spent some time with me that night. He spent probably 3 or 4 hours driving around, and what it seemed that way. And he told me a story. And when I was shaking my head real good, he set the hook. You know, he got me bobbing and saying, "Man, what have I got to do? Let them ask you what it is they have to do." And I started to ask him, "You know, what I got to do, man?" He laid out a program of action, and he told me exactly what it is that I needed to do on a daily basis to not have to drink and to not have to live the way. He kept saying, "You don't ever have to live that way again. You don't ever have to feel this way again. You don't ever have to take another drink if you don't want to." And I didn't want to. I did not want to live the way I was living. And for some reason, because of the identification that took place that night, I was desperate enough to take actions. I became willing to take actions that I would have never, ever taken. But I think both of those ingredients must be there for that process to take place for me. And that is, one, that I'm desperate, that I'm done, that I don't think I can do it. And two, the identification that takes place between two alcoholics, and only takes place between two alcoholics. And he laid out a program of action for me that I lay out, I laid it out this week for a new guy. The same thing. He told me I needed to call him every morning at 7:15, not 7:14, not 7:16. And I didn't have a phone. Posed a bit of a problem. I didn't have a car that ran. Posed another problem. I had to walk down to my folks' house and use their phone. And I was edgy. They called me jumpy and quick whenever I got the A, because you didn't sneak up on me, because I would lobble to pee on myself. I was like a little dog. I was just beat up, you know. And I had broken out in this rash. And it was my arms were really bright red, and I looked, you know, like a real winner, and I was quick, and I remember walking. I walked down to my mom and dad's house, and I was using the phone, and my sisters would be, you know, getting up and around, and I was down at 7:15. I'm waiting for the clock to click over to 7:15, and I pick up the phone, and my sisters, when I get off and start in, "What are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing?" And I'd say, "I'm, you know, call my sponsor." "What? What are you doing?" You know, they're little kids, and I, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm calling my sponsor." About the third time, "I'm calling my sponsor! Leave me alone!" And that's, and mom would come in and, "Leave him alone, leave him alone, leave, go back to your room." And it was like, "He'll leave soon. He'll go home soon." And I would stomp out and go home, and they'd come pick me up for the meeting, and I'd get to the meeting, and I was like, I was 19 years old when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was like Mikey, the kid Mikey. We switched clubhouses real soon after I got sober, and they put me right to work. There wasn't any of this loving me sober business. They didn't know about that. That hadn't been invented yet, I don't guess. They didn't know about, "Oh, you'll be okay, son." They were like, "See that insulation over there? Grab that and get on up in that ceiling." And I was the goofiest newcomer you've ever imagined. And so I'd just grab it and probably rub some on me on my way over there. I was just goofy. But I became involved. They sucked me into the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. They brought me right where the action was. And they told me if I'd stay in the middle, I couldn't fall off the edge. And that's been the truest thing for me that I've known. And, you know, there were several other things I needed to do. I needed to read my book on a daily basis. I needed to make that phone call. I needed to go to the meeting. I needed to say a prayer on my knees in the morning and in the night. And it didn't matter what I felt or how I thought about God. It was the action that counted. And I learned from a very early time in my sobriety that what counted here is what you do, not what you think. That's good, because I told you how smart I am. And you can see now that I was right. It didn't matter. It didn't matter how I felt. It didn't matter if I felt like, "Give me my pen, I'm getting out of here." It matters that I get up. That's what matters in AA. I never knew that. I lived my life completely opposite to that. I lived my life in a manner of, this is how I feel, this is how I act. They told me that I could act my way into right living and right feeling, that I couldn't feel my way into it. That if I waited around for my feelings to change, that I would die. But if I would take some action, that I could be comfortable and I could live. And so that's what I started to do. And I went to meetings. I'm so grateful that I fell into a group of people that believed in taking the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that believed in sponsorship and believed in home groups. There was no gray area for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm afraid today sometimes there are, it seems like, and maybe I just notice it, that I don't tell the newcomer the real truth, and that is that how you're going to die. What you have is an illness that's never going to get better unless you arrest it through the practice of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, unless you commit your life to doing something else, unless you make Alcoholics Anonymous your way of life, you're going to die. Now, there's a way to do that, and it's laid out in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have many fine examples that walk in front of us that can show us how to do it. But that's the truth. If you have alcoholism, if you have it like I do, you're going to die. And I didn't know that, but they taught me that. And so it became necessary for me to do the things that would allow me to live and be comfortable. And comfort is something that I knew very little about. I always walked around with this nervous disposition, this anxiousness, this anxious awareness, where it felt like something was always going to happen, and I wasn't sure what it was, and there was always the mystery. And so peace, when peace came into my life, I remember I was about, I can't remember the exact time, but I was between 6 months and a year sober, and I was driving down the road, and I remember feeling okay. Anybody remember that? When the first time? I mean, I just felt okay. And I got home and I called my sponsor because I was excited about it. And I called him up because he made me get a phone, which is important if you're new. You should get a phone as soon as you can. And I called him and I said, "Steve, you're not going to believe this. Man, I feel great." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "I'm just peaceful. I feel real." He said, "Don't worry. You'll screw it up." You know, and he was right. I did. But I knew that it could happen. I knew that it was a possibility that a person like me could have some freedom from the rat race that goes on in my own head, which will inevitably lead me back to drink if it's unattended, if I don't take care of it. The problem centers in the mind for the alcoholic, and that's the truth for me. And so I have to do what you do here to get the relief up here so that I don't have to go back out there and do what I used to do. And that's just the way it is for me. Working with other alcoholics has been the saving grace in my life. I was taught very early on. They used to take me on 12-step. I'm telling you, I was Mikey. They'd put me in the back of some old stinking drunk, 4 o'clock in the morning, he'd think I was the cutest thing he'd ever seen. He'd go to poking on me and playing with me and showing me his liver. Oh, Jesus, like I want to see this guy's liver. And he'd look at me. Oh, son, I'm glad you came in when you did, boy. And I'm thinking, listen, Gramps, I've almost died too, so shut up. I just want to go back home and go to bed. And, you know, but they took me. And sometimes I think we forget to take newcomers. I didn't have a choice. They just picked me up. I would be saying, it was like I was a mime. It would be like, no, I don't think I can go tonight. And then they would just show up at my house, you know, and I'm thinking, did this thing not work? They didn't hear me say I wasn't going tonight. And they would just show up at my house. They didn't care how I felt. It was more important to them that I stayed sober and lived than what I felt like or what I thought. God, that's a beautiful thing. I can't forget to do that for the new guy. My wife and I stayed sober, obviously, and we stayed together. We had some time out for bad behavior there in Texas for a while, and we have a good life. And she told you about the last few years, and I'm going to tell you a little about it from the way I saw it. I have been blessed to be an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous for the last 10 years. As I said, we had some time out for bad behavior, and the reason I had some time out for bad behavior is because I quit going to AA for about 6 months when I was about a year and a half sober. And it was, I say I quit. Quitting to me is going to one meeting a week. That was because I was raised very differently than that. But other than that, I've been active in AA. I've done what you've asked me to do. And we have had amazing things happen. Our families have been united. We have been given new lives. We've been given children. I am not fatherhood material. I am not, I'm the kind of guy that thinks he has some kids somewhere. You know, there may be some out there somewhere, but I'm not sure where they're at. That's the kind of person that I am. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous an irresponsible, irrational, childish boy. And you taught me how to walk and act like a man. You gave me the ingredients and the tools necessary to become comfortable and to live in a world in a way which has changed my life and changed a lot of the people's lives around me. I told you about my grandparents, and we had a relationship with my grandparents that was unbelievable. My granddad is now, pretty much we take care of him. He's 83 years old, and we pretty well take care of him. What an amazing thing to happen. What a transformation. Because this is the person who took care of me. Now, in the real world and real people, that's how it's supposed to work. They take care of you whenever you're young, and you take care of them when they're old. But that's not the kind of person that I am. I'm selfish and I'm self-centered. When I got sober, there was a $1,500 bill at the little local store, little gas station that I had ran up on my grandparents, never considering paying that. Never would I have paid that. Never did. They just kept paying it. And what a turn of events that today his mail comes to my house. Today we pay his bills. Today he's a part of our life, and we help him because he can't do things for himself sometimes. He has Alzheimer's. My son, as she alluded to last night, my son found his grandfather dead 3 years ago. They'd been out riding bicycles. Papa went up to take a shower, and he had a massive heart attack and died. I walked in probably 30 seconds after they found him. Now, I'm not well equipped to handle things like that on my own. But because you've taught me what to do in my daily life, I was told that repetition strengthens and confirms habits. And you taught me that to be of service is what I'm supposed to do. And so, and it's not about me. It's not some attribute that I came to AA with. It's something that you gave me. And it was that I was supposed to be helpful. And so I started to go about the things that would be helpful in that situation. And it was an awful time. And it was very painful. And I had to call my wife. And before I called her, I called you. And I called a friend of hers in the program, and I said, Tammy, she's going to need you to go over there because it's a bad deal. And as Satsi answered the phone, Tammy rang the doorbell. You were there. Now how could I not be there if you're there for me? How could I not? And you brought her to me, and you walked us through this, and she was a fine example of Alcoholics Anonymous. My son went through this. The person that he wanted to talk to about this was a guy that I sponsored, a guy named George, that I've sponsored since he was brand new. George is about 45 years old, big old Santa Claus-looking guy with bald head, and that's old Zach's Uncle George, and that's who he wanted to talk to about this. My kids think alcoholics are about the greatest people alive. You know, they've never seen anything else but the good things that Alcoholics Anonymous has brought. When my grandmother died, it was one of the most painful times of my life. I was very close. Her and my grandfather effectively raised me when I was a kid. And I called Dick that morning. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and he answered the phone. He didn't have caller ID, I guess. Thank God. Let me tell you right now, if I sponsor you, you don't have caller ID. I don't want to ever think that an alcoholic might be calling me, and I'm going to look down and make sure I'm going to take the call. Please. God, if somebody had done that to me, I don't know if I'd have been here. He told me what to do. He said, I'm ready. You know what my thinking is? She died in California. I'm thinking I'm getting on a plane tonight. I'm flying to California. He said, what you have to do is you have to get things ready so that whenever your grandfather comes back, he has a place to go and things are taken care of. And that's what sponsorship is. Sponsorship separates the emotion from the principle and allows me to see the principle clearly for what it is and shows me the action to take so that I can survive and be comfortable. And that's what it is. There's been amazing changes. My wife and I are friends. I told her the other day that I thought she was my best friend. And she said, really? Think about it. That's all she said was really. She didn't say, yeah, me too. Or she said, really? Okay. She's one of my best friends, I have to say. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I told you that we had that hate and that love thing going on. In addition to loving her because I have to, because she's my wife and she's one of God's kids, I like her. That's something special. The theme of this weekend is trusting our future to AA principles. In the middle of May of 1989, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, not knowing anything about what would happen here. And because I trusted my life and my future to AA's principles, the man that you see before you today is whole, and he's free, and he's able to stand up and walk around and do the things that normal folks do. And it's because of folks like you that that's possible. And so I want to thank you very much for being here, and please don't go. Thank you.